Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain. Got all the hosts up in the house this morning. Got a couple of callers. Hopefully we can get in Dr. Barry Lattman. Hopefully he'll call in and give us a brief update on the difference in these coronavirus vaccinations and which one does what and what to expect and how it's impacting the numbers in Texas. Also, we're going to have Vincent Montague, who's a sergeant with Cleveland Police Department. He's at an event right now. He's going to call up and he's going to chime in on this topic that we're going to talk about today. And what I want to do, and this topic actually came from one of the co-hosts, John. John is the one who brought this up, so John is going to facilitate this show and this discussion, because we always appreciate, you know, input and show content. But let's go on around the horn and say good morning, everybody. What's up, Ben?
Hey, how's everybody doing today?
Good, bro. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm a little pissed off today, but I just, you know, woke up and watched both those two police videos that are going around. The one with the uniformed military officer, and the other one with the shoving snow on that guy's face. And I'm getting a little frustrated and tired with this shit. This is all I write about, and I actually wrote two stories on what we're talking about today, and I really want to just kind of line up all the police departments and be like, I'm really getting tired of writing about the same thing, and every time this shit happens, everybody says the same thing. We need to look at training, we need to look at this, we need to look at that. You all need to stop hiring these...
Go for it.
Fucking idiot, inept, non-common sense. How the hell do they get to the interview process people and giving them badges and guns and just letting them to run out there and do whatever the hell they want and then letting them get off with no consequences? That one officer didn't get fired, and now he can get hired at another police department. I'm having a day where I'm really frustrated, continually writing about this and talking about this, and I try and maintain an objective stance where I'm like, no, we need to work on training, we need to work on hiring, do this together. We can all work together to make policing better. And then I keep seeing videos like this, and I keep being like, you know, policing in this country as an industry, you guys are fucking up because you're making the job continually harder. And there's so many people like Devlin, like Joe, like Stan, that are constantly doing the right thing and advertising the right thing and working for the right thing. And all you departments keep fucking up. You keep fucking the job up. And how many times we keep being like, oh, it's a bad apple, or it's this. It's like the whole barrel's rotten, and not only that, there's about a foot of piss at the bottom of it, and you need to clean all that out, because we're not fixing shit until you do this stuff. And you can't keep treating these like isolated instances, because they keep popping up. And you keep giving the wrong people the job, and you can't attract the right people, because this is all we see. And I'm rambling now. I didn't start my morning off right. I didn't have coffee. I didn't have cereal. I watched those two videos, and now here I am.
Well, shit, son. I like it.
Well, outside of all that, good morning.
I can tell his face. He's masked up on a video call. So that tells you the type of thought process we have in America.
Why are you talking about me right now? It's not all about me right now. It's not about me.
Why are you wearing a mask right now?
Because he's showing off his L.A. Dodgers mask.
Oh, you know what? I was outside. I didn't realize it was on. Let me just take it off now. I forgot it. You know, forgive me.
Good morning, Tony.
Oh, hello. God bless all everyone. You know, it's funny when you walk around in safety, you happen to wear, you know, championship gear. You kind of forget.
On a Zoom call.
You kind of forget that it's on, you know, so. But just wanted to say hello, everybody.
It is upside down.
So, good morning, everybody. You know, God bless you out here in the land of angels. I forgot that I even was holding that. Yeah, but yeah, it's a great day in L.A. You know, we are proud of our Dodgers. Did anyone catch the home opener? Justin Turner.
No.
Yeah, Justin Turner with our solo home run. You know, we had a good home record. Away record, 5-2. But in any case, you know, I just wanted to say God bless you guys. I wanted to just
bless Dodger Nation and bless the rest of the world as well. Happy to be here. But thank you guys. I'm feeling really good and really blessed right now. Oh, I got my Dodger cell phone today.
Let that guy on.
All right. Okay. What's going on, Chief?
Good morning to everybody. Been a heck of a week. Went from Izzy to Dodger Nation with Seth. That was a heck of a transition. But Izzy's right. I haven't seen the second video you referenced about the snow being pushed in somebody's face, but I watched the one with the gentleman in the military gear. That was a complete disaster. And actually, after I watched that video, I watched it with some of my command staff, and my comment was, hey, tell those people to quit trying to help us. You're not helping us. You're not helping us at all. So I look forward to the show. Been a busy week. Got my second vaccination. So, I mean, I guess I got 5G or government tracking or whatever the conspiracy is now. So government's going to be pretty bored because I really don't do too much. So anyway, but hey, everything's good. All good here.
All right, bro. Let me say good morning to B-Garn, Mike James, Melanie Carter, everybody over on Facebook, Waco, ATL, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Appreciate you guys. Big Joe, what's up? How was your week?
Hey, man, I got to go with Izzy. I saw the videos. I watched them. But let me just say what happened to me this week. I had to do an interview. You love with Izzy. I had to do an interview of an officer that was trying to come to an agency. And this officer had been in involved in the last 6 years in at least 3 shoots. Guess what? He didn't get hired.
Good.
I'm going to make sure he never gets hired.
Good.
So, no, here's the thing. Everything starts with one. I mean, if you look at the right moment, I mean, even though King was alive, the catalyst was not even Rosa Parks. It was another lady that actually started it before Rosa Parks. I mean, for historical references, to be correct. But she wasn't. She didn't have the face, so that's why they moved over the parts. That's just a little side. But everything starts with one. And I agree that there are enough of these guys that are, as you say, so eloquent in fucking this thing up. We know. I mean, trust me. We feel the heat now. Chicago is about to go on standby because they're about to release the video of the 13-year-old getting shot. Who knows, and behind the Chauvin case, and that's something I think we've got to go back into. We hit that right on the head. I think everything we talked about was right on the money, from the jury selection to what they're doing now. I think that the prosecution this week did an outstanding, phenomenal job. But the defense also did their job, too, and that was to raise doubt. And that's exactly, if you remember, that's what we said. So, again, I think we're right on the money on these issues.
Yeah, we definitely got to give a shout out to Billy Clark, who really honed us in on a lot of things, and you know that we could expect to see. So yeah, that's interesting. Let's go to the man of the morning, Big John Ruffin. Come on, John, talk to us, bro.
Big Joe. You gonna get the chief in first or what?
We already got it. Use our break.
Good morning. Interesting week, like always, been busy, full of excitement and good things happening. I have no reason to complain about what life has given me. Coming from where I came from, in the direction that my life has headed, to be able to be part of this is just remarkable, and it's part of the testimony, and as Joe said, put it in the books, man, and all this is becoming part of the book. Can I go into today's show, Stan, or you want to?
Yeah, John, how did you come up with this? I mean, not me or Joe. You came up with this, and you. So, yeah, bro, if you would tell a story, let's get right on into it.
Yeah, well, I guess Billy Clark made the comment that when he gets pulled over by a black officer, he feels safe. And I began to think, man, is there an additional pressure on black officers? When a black officer pulls over, let's say a black guy, treat him some type of special way, knowing the historical history of black people getting pulled over. Is the black officer, even when he pulls over a white person, is he supposed to treat them a special way? But then I began to start thinking, like, what if that black officer was riding with a white officer? Do he still have the same attitude, or do he begin to show the white officer that I really deserve this badge, I really deserve this blue uniform? So there's a thin line between black and blue. Now, black and blue usually are the marks that we get when we get injured or abused, or you get black and blue. And I started really thinking about black and blue, what it must mean to a young Joe Mosley pulling over someone and he's riding with Chief Devlin. Do he need to fill, is there a need to fill the show, Jim, that I need to do my job a little extra to show that I deserve this uniform? Or is he relaxed? And when he's not with Jim, how do the young Joe Mosley act when he pulled over a brother? Do he look at him as a brother, or do he look at him just as a regular person? Do you write that ticket because you're with Jim? And do you write that ticket when you're without Jim for a minor infraction? So with that being stated, that I got a couple questions for Jim, man, because, you know, it must be rough with him as well, man. If a young Jim, way younger than what I'm looking at today. No, but I think it, in all seriousness, there's pressures on Jim as well to balance what we call justice. And is he's under any obligation? Because there's a certain guilt that certain white Americans carry and some white officers carry, because for so long, and these are white people, what I'm talking about with consciousness, a conscious Jim Devlin looking at services was like, oh, man, let the guy go. It's just a minor fraction, you know, the consciousness. So I want to begin with Joe Mosley.
Hey, John, if we can do this real quick. We got Dr. Lackman, and he's got limited time, and he just got in, so we just real quick, and we'll get right back to it. And, you know, Dr. Lackman, good morning. How are you? Yes, sir. Can you hear
us? Good morning. I was wondering if you guys could hear me.
Yes, sir, we can. Can you update us on all the different vaccines and what exactly what's going on with them, and especially there in Texas?
Okay, well, let me go first. We'll start first with the approved vaccines. And, you know, and also I want to go over with you some of the evidence that supports why it's especially important that communities of color and communities with risk get the vaccine. Okay. So let's start with the vaccines. You have two vaccines which are approved for emergency use, actually three now that are approved for emergency use. The first two were the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer biotech vaccine. And they have the most evidence that supports both their efficacy and their safety, and that they last the longest, all of which are key, that they last, all of which are key elements. These vaccines are developed basically by genetic engineering based on genetic techniques, but they do not contain genetic material. So they cannot modify your genome in any way. That's just the production method. their approved efficacy for serious disease approaches 100%, and for preventing any illness is in the range of 90% plus. If you want to parallel, the most effective single vaccine that we have besides these two vaccines is the measles vaccine, which is about 90% effective. So these are very, very, very effective diseases. The evidence, except for some very rare allergic reactions to the Pfizer vaccine, for the safety of these vaccines is really, really good, probably better than most of the things we're presently using. So those vaccines are great. A disadvantage of those is that right now they seem to require the approved use requires two doses. And there's good evidence that they work well against the British variants of the disease, but not nearly as well, but have somewhat diminished, but still very effective. People have talked about how these vaccines may be somewhat less effective against the South African variant, but when you look at the published evidence on the efficacy, it's still 20 points higher than a good year of the flu vaccine. So 20% higher. So that's still pretty good effectiveness. The next one down is the Johnson & Johnson. The Johnson & Johnson has the advantage of a single dose. It has, because some of the trials were done in Britain and Africa, it has a good evidence that it's effective it's as effective against the South African strain as it is. However, on the whole, in preventing illness, it is somewhat less effective than the Moderna and the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines. It is a different and more classical technology for having developed it. Oh, well, I also need to mention that one of the great strengths of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine is because of the way these vaccines are engineered and made, it's a very, very simple process that only takes a couple of months to come out with a new vaccine for a new variant. So the Johnson & Johnson does not have that advantage. They basically would have to start over again, go through the whole year process of development that they went through in order to develop it, whereas you could, you know, it's sort of like pivoting on a dime, you know, to develop a new variant. And as a matter of fact, the manufacturers, the Moderna manufacturers, are already about that business of developing specific variants. Those are the three which are approved for emergency use. Now you need to understand approved for emergency use. Approved emergency use is not like you go out and you buy insulin for diabetes. It's approved. They're still waiting for more evidence for full approval of safety. How long is it effective? Another kind of limitation to understand, and this will helps understand why the CDC is still recommending masks, is that until about 2 weeks ago, when you look at vaccine efficacy, particularly for something like COVID, your first question is, does it prevent people from dying? That evidence is very clear for all three vaccines and very effective. The second evidence think about is, does it prevent serious illness? Again, that evidence is pretty solid and very good. The third one is, does it prevent you from being infected? You may be infected, but you may get only a mild case. That's true of many of the vaccines that we have. And then the fourth standard level of this, does it prevent you from transmitting the disease to other people? It's only within the last 2 weeks that we have gotten solid evidence that says that you probably cannot transmit the disease. Now, the question is, can you become infected with COVID? That third question I asked, can you become infected with COVID? I want to point out that many of the vaccines that we presently use, which are viewed as very accepted and effective, do not prevent you from acquiring the virus. They prevent you from becoming sick, and they prevent you from transmitting the disease. We have no vaccine which has ever been tested in which you can still pass the disease, even if you acquire it. So that of the 30 or so things or 40 things we have vaccines against, in no case can you give somebody a case of the disease of a kill virus vaccine, by acquiring the illness. So you would say, well, that's got to be true of COVID too. No, it's not true until it's proven. And now we have evidence, hence the beginning of the loosening that we've seen from the CDC, that you do not transmit. Once you're immunized, you do not transmit. Now, there are other vaccines. We have the vaccine which we've seen, which is being used in Britain, that comes from AstraZeneca. That has had some evidence that it may have some troubling but rare side effects. But the initial release of caution in Britain and so on was probably overdone and an overreaction, like the Pfizer vaccine causes rare allergic reactions in people with allergy. You probably get some clotting problems, which are some concern. We need to look at whether there are special populations which should not receive the AstraZeneca, but that vaccine is not approved in the United States for even emergency use. There's also a vaccine out from Novartis. The Novartis vaccine, Novavax, is in trials in the United States, and they have released their international trials and now applied for emergency use authorization. This vaccine is highly effective. It is biologically assembled. So it's different from the mRNA vaccines in the technology, but it is similar in that it's basically, it's like if you built your own computer out of components. That's the best way you can describe it. They put the components together, the virus is very highly effective, so far extremely safe, and they were just slower to get to the place that the other three vaccines have gotten. And then there's yet another vaccine out there that Peter Hotez from Texas Children's is involved in that's going along at a slower rate for approval. So we've got lots of different variants here. Now, what's the epidemiology of serious disease? Why some of the evidence that we have seen that people of color are more likely to become seriously ill and die from vaccines. And the last thing I want to talk about is I want to talk about COVID infection as a chronic disease. In terms of the question of the question of is this another Tuskegee? Is it similar in any way to what we saw come out of South or Central America? The answer is that to the credit of our society, one of the places we have learned the process for review of any proposed vaccine or study is completely different than it was when Tuskegee or the experiments in Central America happened because of the level of review. And so any proposed study gets reviewed by an expert committee, which also includes ethics experts, both at the institutional level of whoever proposes it. That's a requirement. And then it gets reviewed by several committees at the federal level before you can do the study. So there are many more protections that will work. It's not 100% guarantee, no. What we have seen in the evidence so far of the epidemiology, some of the work done right in Texas, in Dallas, by the Parkland Center for Clinical Innovation. The Parkland Center for Clinical Innovation, and if you go on the Dallas County website and see where the cases are occurring, you see that they're in areas which are predominantly minority, and if you look at the prevalence of both the cases, the deaths, and the serious illness, again, there's an obvious health disparity. The question is, why is that disparity? Is it driven by your particular race or ethnic group in itself? Is it driven by economic disparities in the United States and poverty, or is it driven by the prevalence of comorbidities from a greater incidence of chronic disease in those populations? In other words, an outcome of the disparity. And the answer is the last. If you look at the work that PCCI has done, the number of comorbid conditions like heart disease, diabetes, chronic kidney disease, and those three actually have more effect on how seriously ill you get and whether you die than whether you have pre-existing respiratory disease, which, again, drives us to this last point of another point that COVID is not just a disease of the respiratory system. It affects a vast variety of body systems. And my way of looking at it is that another factor also in the that's disparity driven is if you look at who does the work in this society, which involves human interaction, and people who are more likely to take public transportation, all of those are disparities in our society related to ethnic and race factors that we've perpetuated over the last 400 years. So we've set up the disparities in the society have really set up a perfect storm where people are minorities are at higher risk. So rather than arguing that those people should not get the vaccine, to my way of thinking, they should be at the front of the line. This is an opportunity for us to reverse the disparities, and that makes public health sense as well to take people, regardless of their race, look at what they do for a living, how they get to work, and to possibly. Unfortunately, the governor in Texas, in contrast to some other states, elected not to follow that approach and actually forbade, Dallas County did an initiative where they were going to particularly emphasize those areas. They found other ways to do that, but they were forbidden by the governor by specifically saying that if you lived in specific zip codes, you got preference for the vaccine. Now, let me get to the last point that I was going to make about chronic illness, because one of the arguments, of course, that's been raised is that we know that for some reason, younger children seem less likely to be infected, and because of the lack of comorbidities, probably are less likely to get serious illness or die. What about this idea? Well, there were outbreaks in the Big Ten early on, particularly in Ohio State and Penn State, in athlete populations. In the Ohio State cohort of athletes, they looked at some of the factors along with infection, and 20%, one out of every five of these healthy, young, athletic people who acquired COVID, not related to the severity of illness, developed elevations in a heart, an enzyme in the body, found in the body chemical called troponin. And troponin is released by muscle, heart muscle, which is damaged. So what that indicates, and if you or I were to get chest pain and go into the emergency room, the first blood, they would do an EKG, they take a history, they would do an EKG, an electrocardiogram to look at heart activity, and they would draw a troponin level to see if our heart muscle was damaged. Those are all evidence of a heart attack. So if the troponin values are elevated in athletes, that says, and that's regardless of the severity of your infection, that indicates that there is heart damage, and the question is whether there's chronic illness. In the last week, we've had evidence of persistent neurologic and changes from the disease, and we have the fact that about 30% of those who have had proven COVID have a chronic syndrome lasting at least several months, and we don't know how long it lasts. What this argues is that being infected with COVID in a significant amount of the population causes ongoing health problems. It is not acute illness. It's not like getting flu and recovering in that regard. And the other thing is that we now have people speculating about whether, you know, we know now that as the weather gets better, it looks as if we see decreases in the disease, maybe because people are outside more and more socially distant, but maybe because of characteristics of the virus. We don't know that. But we're seeing these decreases, and the decreases are driven by several things. One thing the decreases are driven by is that they're driven by the fact that the more people have caught the disease and have natural immunity. So they're also driven by the fact that we've immunized a substantial percentage. I mean, the President administration has done a really superb job of getting the vaccine out and available. There are glitches and there are holes in it, but on the whole, they've done so much better than the previous administration at common sense types of distribution. If you remember when I talked with you all early on, I commented that once the vaccine was approved, there would be, from my experience here in Texas being on the immunization committee, that there would be problems in distribution, and that the problems of distribution were largely driven by a flawed distribution system where vaccine that flows to those who have inbred disparities, disparities we've created in the society, that vaccine has to pass through more hands. So if you get your vaccines through your local Walgreens and you happen to have Walgreens in your area, it passes from the manufacturer to Walgreens. If it comes through the public distribution channel, CDC, to the state to the local people, it passes through four or five hands. A delay of a week for each of those means that vaccine is not as available often to those who are most vulnerable. The Biden administration has eliminated those by distributing directly to the federally funded community health centers, as an example, where you address the disparity directly. It doesn't flow through all those other hands. So there's been a lot of that, and we've seen the increases. So where are we in terms of this whole concept of herd immunity? The herd immunity The guy in the Scott, what was his name in the Trump administration, who had the, you know, a lot of the authority, he was not qualified to understand the public health implications. The guy's a diagnostic radiologist. He reads chest X-rays for a living. He doesn't do public health. The public health authorities all said, we don't know what herd immunity is going to be. If we look at the diseases
right.
that we know about herd immunity percentages, it ranges from 10% for SARS. If you have 10% of your population infected with SARS, you can't transmit the disease, to over 90% for measles. With the characteristics of the COVID vaccine, it is more like a COVID disease. It's more likely that it's like measles, where you need 90%. And most of the early speculation was around 70%. That's now up to 85%. So assuming, and we don't know this for sure, that you get long-lasting immunity from being infected, and that if you get the vaccine, you acquire long-lasting. We only know for the vaccine, you keep it for 6 months, and we do know that there are some recommendations now that people who get the disease also get vaccinated, because it looks like the vaccine is actually more effective in giving longer lasting immunity than having a mild case of the disease. So
let me ask you this.
But let's lay that all aside. Okay. Let's say that both the vaccine gives you long lasting immunity and having natural infection gives it. What percentage of the population would have to have one of those two types of immunity in order for us not to be able to transmit the disease to each other? That's probably about 85% of the population, and right now we are probably at about 25 to 30% with the two combinations. We're a long way away, so that means we still have to wear our masks, practice our social distancing, until we begin to get to those levels of immunity and protection in the population. So with that, I think I'll stop. Take questions, comments. And, you know, because that was a lot of information.
Yes, sir. Well, Doc, we appreciate it. And, you know, it's a lot of notes to take down here. And we appreciate you taking time out to be here and to give us all that critical information that we absolutely needed. And we're gonna get into our other part. We got our other guest here, and you're welcome. Please to stay.
Stan, before I move on, I threw a lot of information at you. Let me give you some bullet point capsules to boil it down. Okay. Keep your social distancing. Keep your masking. Get your vaccine as soon as you can. Any one of the three, they all have advantages and disadvantages. Take what you can get, because supply is still somewhat of an issue, although that's getting better. Expect that you may get some minor side effects from these. They're vaccines. They're not, if you have serious allergy, I probably wouldn't take, you know, problems with allergic reactions. I probably wouldn't do the Pfizer. Or I at least would be cautious. And the CDC has been pretty good on grounding. They're now saying, of course, you can, if you've been vaccinated, it's safe to travel on an airplane. I believe that. Small group gatherings are okay with trusted family members. Still stay away from a large public groups, and you'll probably get through this fine.
All right, Doc. Well, we appreciate you taking time out to be here with us and giving us all that information. Hopefully people will go back and listen to this again and break it down. And, it's, you know, when they're available, they'll get their shots. And we appreciate you once again.
Okay, thank you. And everybody stay safe and stay healthy.
Yes, sir. Big John, we're going to turn back over to you. We got our guest, Sergeant Montague, is with us. Good morning, Sergeant. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, we're good, bro. We're good. We're ready. I'm going to turn you over to the co-host, John Ruffin, who this is actually his show, and Joe and everybody, we're all here, and let's go on and get into the meat and potatoes. Go ahead, John.
Yes. I think I left off with asking Joe a question, and that was, as a black officer, did he feel an additional pressure to look out for the black driver when he pulled him over, and did he feel an additional pressure to be a little harder on him when he's working with a white officer and they pulled over a citizen under the same circumstances? So I believe that was the question, Joe. You have to unmute yourself, Joe. Although I love you muted. I know you do.
I came back at the right time. Man, do I love being muted too. Wow. My man, John. My man.
Go ahead, Joe.
Let me try this, because we're having an adult conversation because the kids spoke up.
Remember, I come from the family. My FTO was a Vietnam veteran, Hispanic guy. I was never taught to hate anybody because of their skin color. So my job, as I viewed it, was to go after the bad guys, black, white, or different. So I didn't see that. The only people I gave breaks to, in my eyes, were the elderly and the youngsters. I mean, that's, you know, old folks. What do you want to do with old folks? Old people, you know? Because the one lady said, listen, I've been driving long and you've been on the job. She was right. So what do you do with that? But also with, in my time on the job, we had this thing called discretion in a lot of times. Red light violations weren't as... they weren't revenue generators like they are now. I mean, so you have to look at the progression or digression of police work. Are they revenue generators? Is this truly a issue of civil unrest, civil, you know, distress? You know, police didn't get called for casting a tree, unlike TV and those kind of issues. Now, if you look at the vibe in the calls and the types of calls, everything is a police issue, and it's not. But everything is now being put into the category of, is a police issue, call the police. Somebody's having a mental issue, call the police. The kid doesn't want to go to school, call the police. We used to have this thing called truant officers. They got rid of them. So now it's a police function. I've actually had calls of man, dog and a man. Well, help me run. So some of the things just didn't make sense. But as far as I could, oh, great. Unfortunately, I didn't see that I had to adjust because of race. I just, because you were to ask, pardon my language. And that's the way I saw it.
Hey, John, can I inject something really quick? And to Sergeant Montague, when we talked yesterday, he's right there where the Tamir Rice shooting happened. And he's well aware of it. And that's in light of the topic today, that had to be a particularly hard time for him in Cleveland with the community sentiment, the police sentiment, and being a sergeant, he's right there in the middle. Ben, if you can, you don't have to go into any details about it, but how does that impact your officer?
Wow, that was a tragic, one of the most tragic incidents that I've witnessed or been involved in on the job. And it was tough being an officer at the time, because you have to deal with the emotions of the community and show empathy within the community. And being an African-American officer, it was difficult because you do empathize with the community that a 12-year-old child just was killed. But internally, you had to be silent because if you're the minority, your coworkers are justifying it, and they're not showing that empathy. They were mainly talking about his mom. They were saying that he shouldn't have had a gun. She's a bad mother. To the point to where talking about the kid and saying he was a bad kid, he smoked weed, like nothing to say, talk about the shooting itself. And it was sad seeing that because being in between, you know, with the community and being a police officer, understanding the community, but if you express that you understand the community internally, then you kind of would be ousted. And so it was a difficult balance.
John?
Yeah. How do you balance Black Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter? How do you find balance in between those two? Who do you want to answer that? I want to try to sound like Joe talking about Joe. Well, that doesn't mean me, but I think. But I will say this: particularly for me, I think I've said something about some of our links. There's a couple of blogs here in Chicago that absolutely orient like is king for saying that doesn't matter the movement. And I agree with that. Black officers that have shown a likeness or a understanding of Black Lives Matter, the movement, it's been ripped apart. Monique was just talking about the Tamir Rice, but now Chicago just had a 13-year-old shot. And the nickname allegedly was Little Murder. And he's out at 12 o'clock at night. We're getting ready for riots. So, you know, at one time, they talk about Tamir Rice, and he's playing with a toy gun. This guy's carrying a real gun. 12 o'clock in the morning, 12 o'clock at night. But unfortunately, they get a different type of light, if that makes sense to anybody. We are villainized. Across the board. You're assumed to be guilty by the virtue of being black. If you don't believe that, look at these videos. Look at this traffic stop. Look who's getting shot in this country. I mean, don't get me wrong. I've been in a couple of shoots. Are there some bad guys out there? Definitely. Are they all bad guys that are black? No. But that's not what's borne out. If you look at the TV shows, who's the villain? Who's the bad guy? I used to say one of my favorite movies was Star Wars. Who's the bad guy? Darth Vader. What is he? Black. A big black guy. He's 6 feet, whatever. He's got all the physical powers, but see that as his mate. But again, do we have a problem in this country? Yes. Policing has a problem with black people. Let's just call it what it is. I mean, it's not all over the place. I mean, I love to work with Jeff Dell. I love working with Stan. That's not what's happening. That's just not what's happening. As eloquently as Isidore started, I see this is fucked up, and it is.
I can cut you off for 1 second, Joe. First of all, you sound a little Tyrone K. Dunmore-ish with your Dark Vader analogy. The stormtroopers were white.
He had a white backup. But they work for the black guy.
But you know what, though? I think, on a serious note, though, I think that for all the think tanks that are out here, all the police unions that are out here, all the so-called feel-good counseling sessions and pseudo-programs that departments pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to bring in, no one ever wants to come to the black or female or to the minority officer, particularly black officers. I have to go with my experience and say, it's got to be rough for you. And one of the things that is aggravating when you have black officers who can empathize with the least of the community because you live with them, you know their kids, or you live in this environment, is when you're compared to another black guy who may not feel the way. Why aren't you more like him? And we are not allowed to be individuals. We cities love to say we've got X amount of blacks, we've got X amount of Latinos, we got X amount of women. They love to boast about those demographics. Just don't be too black at work. That's where the problem comes. We're going to pay you to speak Spanish and interpret, but don't be too Spanish here. Go ahead, John.
I don't want to discuss your situation, but I would love to have had a officer from your department that was black, and I'm sure if he was on the show, he would admit that, you know, he's been around some officers and who felt like, yo, what do you think of that Stan Mason, man? That guy, you know, he got the nerve to be suing us or whatever the case may be. How did that black officer respond about Stan Mason at this time? Is there pressure on that guy to say something opposite of what he really feels? A lot of black officers can't make that, they can't express the way they truly feel, because it's almost, just think about this. And Jim Devlin, just think about a mixed child, a child who's half Irish and he's half Jamaican, right? That child goes through life struggling because he's not black enough and he's not white enough. So for the, what I'm saying to the black officer, if they're a feel of not being, because the community, because of the uniform you wear, the community may perceive you as not black enough, Joe. And what is it, Officer Montague, you may not be perceived as black enough because of the blue uniform you have on, but you also may not be considered blue enough because of the black skin that's under that uniform.
Mm-hmm.
No question. There's no quality?
No question. If that happens, I've been called a few things. I've been called a race traitor. I've been called a few things. I will tell you this. The fact that you do have officers like me, Stan, and Devlin, with a pushback. I mean, I would love to sit and tell you good stories, but I don't have enough of them. I can tell you, when I came on the job in the police department, they wrote, "Niggas go home with my police locker." I mean, those are, and only people that get you are my police officers. So, no, I get it. But that still does not mean that you cannot do your job well. Just because there's other assholes, I'm not going to be one of them. I'm not going to beat down on my people, who are everybody, be they white, poor, Hispanic, whatever else, just because some asshole with a badge thinks he's got one. I'm not going to do it. But I want to ask the chief. Was there any pressure on him in his early year working with I don't know if he ever worked with a black officer, and was there any additional pressure on you going into a black community, and you, because sometimes people want to talk a certain way to make themselves fit in. Some people call it talking black, whatever that means. I'm for sure Tony could define it. But was there any types of pressure on you, Chief,
there was. Now, my first field training officer was an African-American man. So the first contact that I ever had was a seasoned individual with the agency. And I probably learned more from that person than anybody else I was with. Now, additional training officers I had, there was a certain, specifically with one, it was pushed harder on the African-American black community than it would be on the white community. And I wasn't good with that. That really bothered me. And there was pushback for me early on. I'm surprised I didn't get fired, but it's just the truth. But like Joe, you know, we had enormous amounts of discretion, enormous amounts. So I couldn't get penalized for utilizing my discretion in a contact that I didn't feel we needed to push or make even more, even something even further ruin somebody's lives for a minor infraction. It just didn't make any sense. I took that information with me. I've held that information dear because then when I started training, I pushed to the fact that it's we got to treat everybody the same. They got to be treated as humans. Now, does everybody do that? Joe has example after example of where that stuff has not taken place, but we need to push that in the community of policing. Now, when you talk about it, you're not seen as black enough or Hispanic enough. Some of those become societal issues. And I've seen it just like Joe. Now, I personally haven't had data, but then, you know, obviously my white skin, but many of my friends, the officers that I work with, they took a beating from citizens because they weren't black enough. So they weren't seen as being empathetic enough, even when these were really bad people. I've heard I had a sergeant called by the N-word by an individual on a call for service, and I've heard Uncle Tom. I mean, it's just insane that they have the double duty, and it's twice as bad for some of those officers in dealings with the contacts with the people than it ever will be for me. It's pitiful. These guys are just trying to do the job and put the bad guys away, and they get an extra measure of being kicked in the ass as a result of the color of their skin, and it's just not fair to them.
You know, Chief, let me real quick interject something, because with Sergeant Montague here, because this is important, I think, for people who will say, well, I don't see that within policing. Why are there black police unions that exist in departments where you already have a police union? What is it that these officers feel we're not getting heard over here, so we'll start our own union? Now, Sergeant Montague, you're the president of the Black Shield, correct?
Correct.
Can you just take a minute and tell us about why you feel that organization is needed? What guided you guys to get to where you developed that organization?
Okay, well, the Black Shield, it started in 1946. It started out as a social club because black officers, there weren't as many as there are now that are within the division of police. When they were on a job, they weren't able to speak with each other because it would scare their coworkers. So they had to find a place to they met at someone's house to where it was like five officers met at the house and start socializing about their experience of being police officers. And from that meeting in 1946, we moved on to becoming an association in 1972, where we fought more rights for inclusion on the job. So we filed a lawsuit with the city of Cleveland so that there were unfair hiring practices. From that lawsuit, there became a consent decree in Cleveland where they were forced to hire more minority officers. After that, we also fought for women's rights on the job, to where women had to be in the detective bureau and wear skirts. So after that lawsuit, women were able to patrol the streets just like men. And these issues that we're fighting for, or that we have fought for, those aren't issues that the union fight for or push for that inclusion, for minorities to have the same opportunities as Caucasian officers on the job. So we're still fighting with those issues to this day.
Wow. John?
Yeah, I want to go back to Sergeant. I admit I was, because I was a criminal, and I thought like a criminal. At one point in my life, I looked and perceived everybody as a house N-word, including my brother. When my brother became a cop, I stopped speaking to him. I was incarcerated for 40 years, and here I was cutting my brother off. And, you know, one Thanksgiving, he snatched the phone from my mother because she was naming everybody that was at the house. And when she mentioned his name, I was like, man, I don't want him about that dude. Like, you know, and he must have seen the expression in my mother's face and how hurt she was that her second or eldest son felt that way about his older brother. Her not understanding the dynamics of the streets. Here I was in jail still running the gang. Here I was in jail still getting drugs in the jail system. I was still in my criminal element. Nothing changed. The reputation got bigger because I was that dude in prison making moves, making things happen. And she snatched the phone and said, you got something to say. And I didn't want to say nothing to him. I could have easily, like, went in or whatever. And he said, well, bro, you ain't got to say nothing. He said, you don't speak to me because I clean our community up of murderers, drug dealers, and rapists. And you call yourself a righteous Muslim, black Muslim, and you're doing all that black power stuff. He said, but all your friends who sell drugs in the community, who are shooting and killing people in the community, you communicate with them. And he said, and you call me the house head, but who's really doing the slave master's work? And he handed my mother the phone, and I said to my mother, man, I got a little tears in my eyes thinking about her. And I told my mother, I said, no, put him back on the phone. And I called him the N-word. I said, put that N back on the phone. And he got back on the phone and said, what? And I lost whatever it was that I wanted to say. I couldn't say anything. And it was that day where the next morning I had a lot of thinking to do. And I went and told one of my co-defendants who was out in North Carolina. I said, bro, I'm done with this gang stuff. I'm going to pass down to you the presidency. You can run the whole jail. You're going to be in charge of all the jails in Connecticut, you know. And he told me like an hour later, after I announced to everybody that he was the president, he was like, well, if you ain't in it, I ain't. You my man. And we were cellmates. And that was like the changing of my life. Because I referred to Joe Mosley, Stan Mason, Sergeant Montague as househeads. So I apologize to you guys today on the air. Although I never said it to you guys directly, I mean, still, you guys go out and do a job. And y'all, don't use the word villainized. Blacks are villainized. So is Joe, Jim, Stan, and Sarge. You guys are villainized today. You guys, when you go into our community, you are looked at as villains, not heroes. All that heroes on their side of the as heroes in the black community today. So you guys are villainized as well. And Sergeant Montague, I know that you probably experienced that where you had to balance the so that you're not perceived as a house end, but you also are not seen as a Black Panther either. Can you share with me, and then I'll let Izzy and the rest of the guys and Tony ask questions, and, you know, I'll shut up for a minute. But to get myself together, I'm thinking about my brother, man. Yes, Sergeant Montague, if you don't mind, can you share how did you balance between appearing as a Black Panther or the house end? How did you balance that?
Wow, and you know what? And thank you for sharing that too. It's okay too to still to feel the way you feel. And that's what I have to tell some officers sometimes, is that if someone – don't get offended because someone in the community doesn't agree with what we do on the streets, or they don't like an arrest we made. We can't get offended by those things. We have to accept that people have different opinions, and some officers I know, they take it personal. And when they take stuff personal, then they lash out on the community. So it's okay for the community to have opinions and think different things, but it's good for us to come together and communicate and express our differences of opinions. And that's on being a police officer. I would say that when I first started the job, I feel like I was brainwashed when I came out the academy. So I was like all in blue, like Blue Lives Matter. I had disagreements with family and friends in regards to policing because we was always taught to justify things. So I was always justifying police actions because I was all blue. I would say that the turning point for me, I feel like I could have done more for my people out on the street. And I've seen white guys terrorize the people in our community. I see them say stuff to people in our community, and I was like, I'm new on the job. I'm just trying to get by. And I ignored a lot of things. But then I found out I was black. I would say when I was in a police shooting, someone grabbed my firearm, I ended up shooting a guy. And the white officers treated me a little differently. It was like they were not they didn't support me during that time. And even my shooting, they questioned it, and they didn't even know what happened. But after my shooting, there was a Tamir Rice, there was a 137 shooting in Cleveland, and they justified those shootings because white officers were involved. And I'm like, what's up with this Blue Lives Matter thing? You know, I'm like, I'm different. And then I start opening my eyes up and seeing how different it was. I'm a member of Kappa Alpha Psi, and I wore a Colin Kaepernick shirt to work one day, and officers were like, he's not pro police. But I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, they don't agree with Kaepernick. They were protesting going to the football games, but they support the insurrection. They were quiet. They had nothing to say when it came to that. And then when I start having kids, I have two boys that are black, and two African American sons, 6 and 8. And then I start thinking about them growing up, and I'm like, you know, I have to change. And so once I start being who I am, wearing my African heritage pants to work, and not being afraid to be black, without caring about their feedback, not caring about fitting in. I've been isolated. I go into rooms and white officers would just walk out, or they don't speak to me. Okay with that, because I'm comfortable with who I am. I can have a conversation with my family. We don't get into it because I empathize with the community, I understand. And I see some younger black guys now, they're trying to fit in. They want to get into different units. They want to go to narcotics. So they're terrorizing the community, making all these arrests and getting guns off the street and all this stuff. And not empathizing with the community. And so what ended up happening is that then they get upset when they don't get these units, but they've done all these things. So it's those moments when they find out, like, yeah, they picked a white guy over me, that they're black. And so when I go into a room and I see Fox News on, I turn the TV off, or I turn the ESPN. Or, you know, if I hear a white guy saying something disrespectful to someone, I step in and say, hey, that's not happening. But black officers need to have that courage to do that. And sometimes it's scary going outside that box. But talking, surrounding yourself with people like Stan and other black officers that are courageous, it helps you in that fight because you see that you're not alone.
You know, John, you asked me something a little earlier, and I'm not going to directly talk about, you know, my situation. But, you know, I'm going to say, before I left Waco PD, I had a brand new officer, young guy, and he was white, and he was in the black part of town. And we worked some calls together, and he would watch how I did things. And, of course, when I got, most of the time, everybody knew me when I got there. But this kid got me off to the side, and I called him a kid. He's probably late 20s, early 30s. But he said, can you teach me? And this took courage for him to say, especially to me, because if he hadn't met me, he's going by the perception of what people who didn't like me would say about me. But he said, can you teach me and help me understand how black people feel and why they feel this way? Because he wanted to do better service, and he wanted to really understand. And for him to take the time to ask me that, when I worked with people who wouldn't even speak to me, and some of them were black, it meant a lot. And that officer today that is still there is a great officer in that community. And he is respected and loved by a lot of people in this black community because he took the time to understand and empathize and talk to people and give people grace and understand that they can't afford this $600 traffic ticket. You know, so that is one of the things that I carry from there that meant a lot to me. So if I answer, you know, your question as best I can right now.
Let me jump back in. John, I got to, first of all, thank you. That was very powerful testimony. But as Tony will tell you and attest to, when I was at his school, I had the opportunity to lock up a bunch of people. I never locked up a kid for marijuana. No, and I wouldn't have done it. I still don't do it because of a couple of things. I didn't see them as criminals. I saw them as kids. Why would I mess up a kid's life because of one action? Now, if they had a gun in their pocket, no, you're going to jail. You had heroin, you're going to jail. See, discretion is something that's taught and learned, believe it or not. It's actually a learned response. Don't let anybody bullshit you on that. But the other issue is the thing of discretion. If you villainize people, you don't see them as worthy. You don't see their worth. So why wouldn't you terrorize them? I mean, it's something that's, unfortunately, that's passed on a generation. And until we deal with this thing of racism, we're going to keep on getting what we got.
No, I agree with you 100%. And, you know, I'll back you up and let everybody know, yes, at our school, you know, Joseph Mosley, as we called him, Officer Mosley, was highly respected and highly revered, you know, and it goes to a larger issue that he understood power. And what I look at, and I'll kind of say this, Stan and I had a conversation a couple of days ago, and I wanted to explain to him, you know, if you take the pastoral title off of me, Tony Tillman is just a regular black male living in L.A. County, who I get very angry at videos, same videos you watch, and the same type of stories you watch and read, I get highly ticked off about, and I want to lash out. I've called Chief Devlin and said, I'm having a weak moment. I'm very angry at white people, at white officers, and, you know, and some of these things I'm not going to repeat, but there's a human side to me, and he's walked me off the ledge, or talked me off the ledge many times. But if you look at, even I looked up the Black Shield Police Association that Montague was talking about. If you read the first couple of sentences about who they are and how they got started, think about this. In 1945, a small group of black police officers met to discuss the unfair treatment of black officers in the Cleveland Division of Police. They didn't meet to talk about how badly they were being treated by the public. They were being badly treated by fellow officers. You know, and that lets you know there is it's always been a power thing in this country. I'm not going to take a long, you know, soliloquy to explain this to people, but I'm only bringing up my conversation with Stan and with Chief is because I have got to do a lot of reading and research to truly understand and just kind of focus in where is the problem. And I know many of you heard me say this before, and it's just like Chief Devlin talked a lot about emotional intelligence. I bring up the Stanford Prison Experiment a lot there's a book I'm reading called Cash. And this book that the author Isabel talks about, this country has always had a caste system in this country, and it's all about power. You know, when you're talking about black officers, they can't talk too cultural. You know, that's nothing new than what the colonizers did to the Native Americans. It's called cultural assimilation. We can't have you be too ethnic or too cultural because it makes us feel uncomfortable. So when you're looking at what is the true issue of what we're talking about here, it's a matter of power. And the caste system, there are police organizations that just feel, and even people in America feel, black people need to remain in a certain place. Why did this 1945 group get started for black police officers in Cleveland, Ohio? Because of a caste system by white people and law enforcement that felt we put black people in a certain type of image. That's what caste is about. Casting is all about, I have an image, I have an expectation of a certain people. And when you fall out of that cast, it makes me very uncomfortable, and I have to do things to change that. And so, you know, now kind of shifting gears to the Stanford Prison Experiment, when you're looking at the officer who pushed the snow in the guy's mouth, you're looking at a Tamir Rice, you're looking at a Michael Brown, all of the hands that have to point out is called dispositional fault, which means we only look at the officer. What he did or she did could have prevented that, and that's where the story ends. But when you really research what Dr. Zimbardo did with the Stanford Prison Experiment, he brought out something called situational forces. There are things around police officers that cause them to do this. You can't have a little baby boy. This is my little baby boy, little baby Eric, who grew up to join the academy. He didn't grow up to want to kill black people and shoot black people. You know, he went through the academy. He came in like Montague. He was all rah-rah-rah for police. That is the environment. I have no problem with that. What my problem is when officers, like with the Stanford Prison Experiment, when there is unchecked power, when if you do wrong, you know you can get away with it. You have the propensity to continue and not just do wrong, but do worse because there's no accountability. And thank you, Pat Schroeder. I'm gonna do it with Stan and I can to leave these things up in the comments. But I'm gonna continue posting links. The cast book I'm reading, the Stanford Prison Experiment movie I'm gonna put in there, because in order for you to really have kind of an enlightened ideology of not hating police, you have to hate the system that allows them to get away with it. And these officers are good people that join the academy and they graduate. And then these are good men and women, but after being in that toxic environment, Dr. Zimbardo called it, he said it is a hyper-masculinized behavior because of daily intense environments and actions that go on. And he was even a part of it when he did the experiment. I won't go into it because I want you guys to watch the movie. But please understand, if you were to watch media stories about how many officers gave 18 black people warnings today, all over the country, 18 black people got stopped by the police and they were given warnings and they all lived. How many police officers were actually seen playing basketball at the local park and no kids died? See, that's boring. And that's why I want to keep reiterating, the majority of police, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, Pacific Island, the majority of police are good police, and they're on our side. It is the fact that the media, and God bless them, it's more click and more interesting to focus on the bad ones, the small minority that is out here who should not wear a gun and a badge, but their power and their wrong behaviors have gone unchecked, and they are not held accountable. That's why when you start hearing these bad officers and they start doing research on their history, this wasn't the first time. Exactly. How did he or she get away with it? That's what we have to deal with, the system of situational forces, not the dispositional person who did it all the time. And that's just where I want to leave. But I'm going to put those in the chat because I want you guys to really, I'm not saying be like a Reverend Tony, but really look at there's more to this because there's so much going on that you need to understand. It's not just don't hate police. You have to hate and want to change the system that allows them to get away with this. Izzy, I'm sorry. I know you want to. I chimed in. Izzy, please go ahead, bro.
One second, Izzy. I got to ask you this question, Tony. I agree with what you said. That's first and foremost. But for the white officer, let's just say a white officer today shoots some unarmed black guy. Where's the fundamental fairness for this white officer when this white officer now, through all these hashtags popping up, and the media is doing that? Do that white officer deserve some type of fundamental fairness?
Great question, and I'll put it this way. We have to, and sometimes we can't get into the mind of this white officer. Again, we'll call him Eric. My famous example is a little baby boy, Eric. He came this police officer who shot and killed this black dude, and he didn't care about all these hashtags. There is a caste system that he has been riding around with that he didn't join. He didn't graduate the academy with it, maybe not, but riding around his partner, going out to drinks and going out to parties with his white counterparts, and all they do is say nigger jokes, nigger this, nigger, all these jokes. And he can't speak up and say, I don't even talk like that. I mean, I got somebody black in my family. So he has to keep that quiet. But see, these are situational forces around him that are actually, he doesn't understand, it's actually changing him. And so where does the caste system come in? It comes in that now he is put black people into a caste position of there to be feared, there to be hated, because that's all I hear, that's all I see, and I'm putting my blue brothers in front of all these other people. So now when he goes out, he's afraid. Why do you look at these videos? You know, and I'm going to say this, Joe was not physical, okay? But we knew that Joe Mosley, Officer Mosley, at our high school, knew how to put us into a grip where we could do with our wrists and bring us to our knees. These officers of today don't understand how to do hand-to-hand combat. You have the brother with the snow in Akron. He was fairly built, but you got, what, eight officers trying to get one man to the ground? Derek Chauvin, George Floyd, all these officers, they don't understand how to do it. So they're in fear, and they're weak, not only mind, but also physical. How many times have we wondered, I wonder what he can bench press? These officers are not very strong, so they go to their gun first, because the caste system in their brain has got them thinking, I am going to be in fear of my life just by your color. Forget about size now. It's all about color. So this white officer, little Eric, who shot and killed this black dude, yes, he's got blame there. But what he won't speak up about and what won't get talked about, what kind of conversations were you and your partner having? How did you get to this place? You see, all we do is we villainize this one officer justly because he did, I would say commit a murder if the brother was unarmed and running and shot him in the back, whatever. But there's other forces at play, and those forces are told to do this because the chief and the union, they don't want the spotlight on them. So it's a much bigger issue than just this one officer who bears blame. But that's what you call a dispositional blame, where we only focus on Eric, and we don't focus on the entire system that has been shooting Eric and or his partner or the other white officers who have been doing the same thing. And it continues. And it's not going to stop because this thing has been rolling for so long. It's a power thing. You do not need a black police union and a other police union. That lets you know that there is still a problem where there is a caste system and that the white officers don't look at the black officers as equals because in their mind, they have a caste of looking at you as inadequate, less than, can't read. Look, you've got Justin Fields going through that right now, and he's a potential first, second-round pick in the NFL draft. So you've got people who just put you in a certain type of caste, a mold, if you will. And they don't want you to come out of that mold because it makes them feel more comfortable. I hope that answers your question, because that's how I feel.
Hey, and this is Montague too, and I had a response to what you were just saying though. If I could have a few, what you just said is actually you have some valid points, and I definitely agree with like what you said, but also too, when it comes to officers, I do think the system itself is the problem, because we reward these officers for being adrenaline junkies, okay? For all these awards for making these arrests, for finding drugs and guns and chasing people down, and then next thing you know, once this incident happened, you're right. They take the blame off the city for encouraging these guys to police in this manner, and then now they are vilified. But for years, is these guys the same guys that get awards and the medals and all this stuff for these courageous actions, but now they're not so courageous anymore. So it is the system itself, because the officer that plays basketball with the guy on the street, he doesn't get awards. So these guys want action. They want to be detectives. They want to do all these things. So they want to police in that manner so they could get those promotions on the job. The person that plays basketball and give gifts out and get groceries for people, they're never rewarded. And if they are, it's someone that's calling the news to take a quick photo op. But for the most part, those aren't the what we call as good police officers. So it is the system, and also police officers have a issue when they get out the academy of their authority being challenged. And that's how you have people that that's how you have people when misdemeanor crimes, okay, when it turns into a use of force because an officer said, you're jaywalking, and someone sticks their finger up at him. He said, what did you say? That stuff, you shouldn't get a use of force or killed for jaywalking. But these are how things happen. And then the last thing was that in these departments, it has changed. There are black mayors, black police chiefs, black safety directors, and these things are still going on. So we are in position of power to make the changes, but we just decide not to make the changes, because when black people get in the position of power, are they going to make effective change, or are they going to continue going on with the culture of policing, or are they going to try to say, well, I don't want to seem like I'm too black, so I want to, like, I don't want to seem like I'm pro-black, so I want to be fair. I don't see, then all of a sudden they don't see race anymore. I don't see race. I just want to be fair across the board. So those are things that I've observed. But thank you for your feedback, though. I appreciate it.
You know, John, if I can say, that was a good question about the hashtag. But let's talk about the first hashtags before computers. Those hashtags were the constant vilifying of the victim in the courtroom. Therefore, look at George Floyd. Look at what we're seeing in that trial, what the defense is trying to do. But we never hear about the officer's history. So, you know, when we look at I understand how that officer will feel, he or she will be the subject of hashtags and so on and so forth, but how long have victims in this country, righteous victims, been thrown in a courtroom, been accused of everything, they skip fourth grade lunch, you know, and we see this over and over and over again, and we paint these victims as the perpetrators. And we're seeing
Murphy's Law protects. The reason why we don't hear about officers and their names while we hear about the victims is because of Murphy's Law. Do a lot of people understand that Murphy's Law, which even LAPD has and they have adopted, protects the officers, their name and everything else about them? That's why you don't hear about them. Look up Murphy's Law. I'm going to put it in the chat. This is why you don't hear about certain officers. Now, certain departments don't adopt it, and Stan and Chief and Joe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I haven't heard of departments close to me that has not adopted Murphy's Law protecting their name. Look at Kobe Bryant. Do you know his widow just got the names of the officers who went around after Kobe and those people were dead in the helicopter. These L.A. sheriffs had their cell phones taking pictures of the gruesome bodies of Kobe and his daughter and other people, and they were just sharing them on the phone, you know, among each other, including people in power. And we found out they were doing that, but you can't bring up their names. But she needed their names to file a lawsuit against them. But she fought tooth and nail. That is, you know, one example of being wrong, but that's why we don't hear about officers.
Yeah.
Joe, I'm sorry.
Murphy's Law only is applicable in California, and the rest of the country is based on contractual issues.
Okay.
That's the problem. But let me go digress a little bit. If you look at, I put up the Afro-American Patrolman's League. If you think what happened in Cleveland was interesting, read Afro-American Patrolman's story here in the city of Chicago. And again, it goes back to what everybody's been talking about, the fact that, you know, black officers, white officers, I mean, we've got a German police association, we've got a Puerto Rican police association, we've got all kinds of associations, but there's only one bargaining unit. Now, listen, there is the key. Now, you can have as many fraternal, social, but which is the bargaining agent? Now, let's talk about power. When we talk about these other issues, they're all baseless as far as I'm concerned. Because the person that controls the contract controls the department and controls the demeanor of those officers.
We're at the 25-minute mark. Ed, let me get you in here because you've done several stories on this.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a couple of stories on this, but I put them in the list. I mean, everything that everybody's saying, it's kind of just like daily deja vu. It's all the same points that are made every day, and they're all correct. I mean, when you think about policing in general, what Tony's saying is accurate. We have to go after the system because the system is the actual issue. Because it's the system that, I don't care how diverse you make your department, it's the system that can make that not matter. That can make black police officers, Latin police officers, minority police officers subjugate and oppress their own people based on the policies and practices of the system. Look at Baltimore, like Chicago, Miami. In all these cities that have very diverse departments comparably to other departments in the country, they have the same amount, if not more, issues of use of force and violence on behalf of police officers. Why is that? It's because of the corruptive effects of a policing system that its foundation is in suppression and oppression of marginalized people. Because the state and the country that wrote these laws wrote them to suppress and oppress marginalized people. And the police enforce the laws of state rights. And that's what's going on. That's what happens. And when you think about the police officers that get into these units, I mean, in my experience in terms of writing stories, I can get any retired officer in the country to talk until they're blue in the face about all the problems with policing. But if I find, and I rarely do, if I find an active duty officer to talk on the record, I have to change their name and I have to protect their identity. Why? Because they will be retaliated against. They have a veritable fear of being retaliated against. I had in one of the stories that I did, I interviewed a Philadelphia police woman. She'd been in the police department for about 4 or 5 years. She asked me to change her name because she said she'd be retaliated against. And the stuff that she told me is all the stuff that we're talking about. That if you want to protest or say that you're on the side or even remotely agree with some of the aspects of the Black Lives Matter movement, you have to do it in silence. You can't wear shirts. You can't broadcast your affiliations or anything like that because they will target you and they will punish you for doing that. Because a lot of police departments look at Black Lives Matter and look at the movements that are going on today as terrorist organizations. And they will go after you and fight tooth and nail to bring you down. So if you're a black police officer, you have to both protest and suffer in silence. You can't march. You can't support the people that are doing this. And there are exceptions. There are people like Joe and Stan who say, fuck it, I'm just going to get up and do it. But we can't expect to change things by focusing on the exceptional cases and the idealistic cases of the people that just said, fuck it, and did it. Because there's too many realities, human realities in policing that we ignore by doing that. And that's the danger of a lot of this comes up with like the hero ideal. The hero ideal in policing is one of the reasons why people get so mad at black officers and Latin officers and any officer and just say, why don't you stand up? Why don't you say something? You're in a position. You can do it. You need to step up. because we have this idealized perspective of police officers as these more than human heroes that will do whatever they have to do to pursue what we think is justice and what we think is right, and it negates their humanity and it denies the realities that they exist in, which, and I've said this before, I've had people tell me on the record after changing their identity that they get death threats for speaking out. And I'm not even talking about like speaking out like speaking against a dirty cop who's running drugs or something like that. I mean like Black Lives Matter, like anything like that. They've had people giving death threats from that. Like Joe said, it happens all the time, and these are the experiences. These people have families that they go after. They have, and that's the scary thing, is that this system, we need to think about that. Like, why, it's asking the wrong why. Like, why don't you speak up? Like, well, why don't they speak up? Is it because they're cowards, or is it because there is a system that will go so far as to threaten their life to keep them silent about any issue that they bring up? And we're not going to change anything until we address that. And another thing that we talk about is, like, we like to bring up the whole, there's a minority of officers that are doing all this terrible stuff. And that is true to a certain degree. But then we also have to wonder about a system, an industry, that is attracting these minority officers to this industry. Why do these bad people come to become police? Because it gives them power, it gives them security, and it gives them a lack of accountability. There's studies that show that terrible people are attracted to policing. Why are they attracted to policing? What is wrong inherently with the policing industry that somebody who wants to rape women just in general is like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to become a cop so I can rape women and get away with it. And that's a real thing. Police sexual misconduct is the second most reported incident to use of force. Use of is cops beating the crap out of people and then cops raping people. And the people that do this stuff are attracted to this industry. We need to start thinking about why they're attracted to that industry and what needs to change. Because if your industry is attracting rapists and murderers, you probably should change some of the stuff about what you're doing. There's got to be reasons why that they're attracted to that. And everything we're saying, it's all the same stuff over and over and over again.
Andy, let me ask you something. In your, because you alluded to this, when you were talking to some of the officers who wanted their names changed, and they didn't want their names put out for fear of retaliation. And did this come up that sometimes the retaliation isn't what they will do to you, but what they won't do for you?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. They won't. I mean, they don't. I mean, especially the African-American female officers that I've interviewed that have wanted to change their name, they get a lot of the brunt of it, because it's two things. It's one, they won't, if you get in a situation where your life is in danger and you get back up, they will not come. They will actively tell you not to come. I've had people comment on the record saying that supervisors, captains have said, do not respond if this person needs help. And then the flip side of it is that they'll actually attract more derogatory, harassing, and violent attention from fellow officers because they decide to speak out, because they know. I mean, I've had officers that there are officers on record that have targeted female officers because they're minorities and female, because they say, and it's a quote, no one is going to believe you're a black ass, and no one's going to believe you're Latin ass. And that's something that they rely on. They rely on the fact that no one is going to listen to these people because they're marginalized, because they're minorities, and therefore that they can do what they want with abandon. But yeah, absolutely. Cops will not respond to backup. You can be in a situation where you're by yourself and you can't trust officers to reply to you because you decide to march with a Black Lives Matter protest. Like,
typical.
Exactly.
Yeah. But here's what's interesting for me. The fact that I just had this discussion with some of my former coworkers, how they can equivocate Black Lives Matter and Tifa and the Klan all in the same breath and think it's okay, because they can deflect, and, you know, because anything black, again, gets vilified, because it cannot, at least in this country at this point, you cannot have a black movement that has the power be nonviolent and directed. That may sound crazy, but think about it.
No, it's not crazy. And anytime they have, the cops usually kill them. So it's really...
But see, again, that goes to the point of this, again, I'm just liking it to that caste system. The power is at stake. There are people in this country, majority of these people happen to be of white nationality, who feel a certain type of comfortability and security with this power of them being on top. And so when anything comes against that, be it Black Lives Matter, be it the Black Panthers, you know, be it Black Excellence, be it the Tuskegee Airmen, you know, be it the voting rights, anything that is knocking at the door of their perceived caste system of power, they get uncomfortable and therefore will do all they can. And in their minds, this thing is so ingrained in this country, in their minds, they will look at Black Lives Matter. They will look at the voting rights. They will look at Black Excellence as being terroristic. You know why? Because in their minds, you are coming for me. And I cannot be in power if you are in power. And that is where we fail as a community of a country, because there's enough country and quote-unquote power for all of us. But you cannot have one group thinking, I have to, you know, remain on top. And in order for that to happen, you have to remain on the bottom. And until we get to the point of, you know, having people understand that quote-unquote power you have and you've had since the colonization of this country, it was unreal, unfounded, and it was immoral and wrong. And everything oppressive has got to come to an end. And that's where the fear is coming in. And that's just how I'm looking at it.
I mean,
go ahead.
I mean, I agree with you on the unfounded and everything, but it is very much real for them. And it is very much real for the history of our country. They definitely have the power. And what's ironic is that even though, like I said, diversification and stuff doesn't necessarily denote that you're going to get a less violent police force. In fact, in most cases, it stays the same, or in some cases, it gets worse. Yeah. The ironic thing is, though, is that police departments around the country are still actively trying to keep minorities, African Americans, out of their police ranks through biased hiring practices. Through biased testing, through all of this stuff. They're trying to keep them out because they do not want that, even though it doesn't necessarily denote that anything about their power is going to shift. They're so afraid of it that they still will not allow, actively will not allow minorities into their police forces, which is why across the board, it's still, policing is still 60-65% white.
More than that. But
we're at 17 minutes.
I got to say this to Tony, and I have vehemently disagreed with the Wilkerson assertion of the caste system being the problem. I know millionaires that reach the Brockman level, Sam Brockman being the liquor guy, they're still not accepted. They still can't break into that caste system. The caste system is not the problem. It's called racism. I don't care how much money you have. That system is not letting you in. They don't give shit about your money. They don't like you, period. And it's got nothing to do with your money because you can match up with them. So it goes back to the little R. It's still racism. No matter how you cut it, no matter how you paint it, it's still racism.
Racism is still misdefined. And its true definition is the systemic practice of oppressing, you know, other people. Bigotry is what happens when there's action. LeBron James living out near Brentwood, you know, close to where I am, you know, having, you know, Negro home written on his fence. They knew who lived at that house. That was not racism. That was bigotry. But bigotry caught on by what? By a caste system that people that look like you don't need to live in this Brentwood area, and I'm uncomfortable having you. I don't have any much money you have and how many awards you got. You are black, and you are living in what's called our area because we form and mold a caste system that you people should not be allowed to live here. So still, you know, but there was no systemic process called racism. It was bigotry forged by a caste system in their mind. That's where she was going with that. You know, but I respect your disagreement.
Let's do this. We're at the 15-minute mark right now. We want to get Sergeant Montague some final thoughts. It took a lot of time out to be here with us. Brother, you got a couple minutes. Give us whatever's on your mind.
Yes. Again, thank you for having me, too. And this was a great discussion. And what I do think, though, is that we do have the power to mobilize, and we showed it in this last election. If people, especially in law enforcement, black officers in the community support the black officers, we could continue making strides to grow in the department and make it better. It is difficult being in those positions at times, and I know being a supervisor now, to make decisions where sometimes your colleagues do challenge you, particularly the Caucasian ones, and then also black officers, they don't understand because they get upset because you may have to discipline them. So things do happen, but black officers and black politicians are having more power across the country, and I think that once they get into that power, they need to use that power and don't forget who they are. And then also, I do think that as a black officer, we need to be encouraged and continue to try to recruit black officers across the country, because it is a system where it's a family system. It's one of the only jobs in the world where you could have a high school diploma and make six figures a year. So, yeah, it does attract certain people, but it does provide that kind of security that one needs, where you don't need to do anything but graduate from high school and go through a six-month police academy. So there are some benefits to law enforcement where I could understand that it does attract – we are finding out that it does attract criminals as well. But we have to continue having these discussions to grow and definitely support each other, because we do spend a lot of time fighting each other instead of supporting each other to grow. And that's where being a black officer, when you have Black Lives Matter, I support Black Lives Matter. But even if we had a disagreement, I'm not going to down them in front of my colleagues. I'm going to have that conversation with them so we could grow together, because the black community, no matter where you're at, we have to work together. And like I said, it showed in this last election. Stan, thanks for having me. It's always good to have that conversation with you.
Appreciate you, brother. Hang on, because John wanted to, I believe John had a question for you. He's coming back. Big John. But we're gonna go ahead and go around the horn, Chief.
Yeah, I mean, a great discussion. Thanks to Marquis for coming on, for his perspective. And, Cleveland's a much bigger agency. He's probably got more on his ship than I have in my department. But, it is a systemic issue, as Izzy alluded to. It takes people to stand up to keep the bad ones out. So we can't continue to police as traditionally has been done. And we need to look at this a little differently through a different lens, and get that, talk about that community engagement of all the community. Everybody needs to be on the same page and figure out the way that we're gonna make this work. More difficult than larger agencies, I understand that. I've got more of a reach with mine because, I see my people every day. I don't have thousands of folks, but it's incumbent upon these leaders to figure that out. I've said before that those even those chiefs and those big agencies probably need to get out of the mayor's office a little more and show up that shit. Probably get in the car. I mean, that's how an effective leader leads. I'm just saying. So a great conversation, great perspectives, and again, I always learn something from the show.
All right, Joe, take over the helm, guide us the rest of the way around, and then you be the final authority, take us out.
Oh, no, I got to hear from Isidore. That's my guy. I mean, the Puerto Rican prince has got a lot to say up there.
Oh, yeah, but you're facilitating everything.
We've got to give a shout-out to a friend of ours, Judge McKnight.
Hey.
Judge McKnight.
That's a homegirl right there, and yeah, she is. And some of what we talked about here, when Tony alluded to, we talked about the system and the corruptness, and you know, that's a perfect example of it. When people are productive, they will come for you.
And read her story.
Oh, yeah.
Vote for her. Vote.
Hey,
Izzy, come on, man.
I mean, I agree with the voting thing. I agree with everything you said. As always, we're talking about all the right stuff. And along with Devlin, I mean, I always learn and defer to you guys who have all the experience. The one thing I just thought of that kind of frustrates me in this whole policing conversation is we always get on the police departments and policing in general about that us and them mentality, which is what leads to use of force instances and racist policing and all this stuff. And I've noticed that lately in the conversation of reforming the police or defunding the police or whatever, it's turned into a conversation of us and them, kind of like an all or nothing sort of thing. We need to talk about defunding the police and getting everything out of there and putting money into the social services and stuff to make sure the police aren't wearing too many hats. Or we talk about police training and recruiting and changing how they do things and changing the culture. We talk about them separately. But I interviewed the chief of police in Houston a while back, and he brought up a good point. We can do all of these things. Like, all of these things can be done. We do not have to sacrifice police training, police hiring, police recruitment, police cultural change in order to get the social services that we need. So while I agree that we need to get police out of mental illness, we need to get police out of police and sexual work, we need to end this drug war on drugs because it doesn't work, we don't need to sacrifice policing in order to do that. We have enough money in this country, and we have enough people in this country that you can do both at the same time. You can improve press policing.
Uh-oh. Is that just
Brooklyn Wi-Fi.
Okay.
Boy, you got to pay the bill, man. Cut off again.
Yep. Okay, Joe.
Hey, man, well, listen. Again, a great conversation.
Let Tony talk.
Yes, let the preacher talk. I mean, Michael, we haven't heard you enough, man. Stop
it. Oh, yeah.
Every time. It does. Izzy, I want you to finish what you were saying, because we missed the last part of
it. I'm really just saying we can do all of it. We have enough money to do all of it. We have enough people to do all of it. You don't need to sacrifice one for the other. I think that's one of the problems of the conversation. You seem to act like in order to get better mental health treatment, in order to get protection for self and sex workers, in order to get better drug treatment, we need to cut out policing, all the support for policing. And while I do agree we need to get police out of those situations, we can do both. Biden just approved like a $500 billion increase to the Pentagon because they needed that money. Like, we can do both. It doesn't have, we don't have to.
You got to fund Black Ops. Come on, man. You got to fund the Black Ops. Bullshit.
I need about a billion if somebody can hook a brother up.
Get a billion. I'll take half a billion. I'm not agreeing. The Pentagon keeps getting it every year, and they keep losing it. They lost $2 trillion 5 years ago, and nobody said shit. And why all of a sudden, any time it comes to improving things that actually matter, we don't have the money for it. But when it comes to bombing people or giving rich people more money, all of a sudden, we've got heavy, heavy bills coffers. And that's one of the things about the problem with the depression. We have enough money to both fix policing and get them out of these areas that they shouldn't be involved in. You don't know.
Was that
off the
band
that you talked to?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and I agree with him. I mean, 100%. You know, where he was, well, down in Miami, but where he was at, you know, they're very resource rich in Houston, and they have a lot of ability to fix those. But they need to start to focus on some areas that around the country that don't have resources like
right.
that, don't have
sure.
hospitals for mental health, and you know, so on. So. We'll work on that billions of dollars from the feds. Get it down here. I'll build a couple of community hospitals.
Hey, Big John, welcome back. We're at the 5-minute mark. Sergeant Montague's still here for your question. If you want to ask it, John, and if you get to close us out this week.
Well, all the officers. The question that I had was,
no one came into this policing thing looking to change the system. At what point in your career did you guys realize that, and I would like Jim to go after, that you realized there needs to be change? At what point of your career? In closing.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, I didn't go into this career thinking I could make changes. I went into this career for stability. And also, you know, in my younger days before I was married, you know, I did enjoy the uniform. So I just was when I was younger, I was in the career for different reasons. But what really changed me, we had a lot of incidents in Cleveland, it was a police chase where they thought the car backfired, but the officers thought they shot at him. And it was 137 shots that was shot into this one vehicle and killed the two individuals in there. And I'm like, wow. And Tamir Rice incident occurred. I became more involved in the Black Shield, and I began speaking out in regards to try to change the culture of policing. And since I became the president of the Black Shield and speaking out, I've been under so many investigations, so many complaints, internal affairs. I've never been interviewed by internal affairs or talked to by internal affairs as much as I have since I've been speaking out. But the community needs Black officers not to be afraid to speak out. And once I've done that, I didn't realize how much support I have in the community. So that's when the pivotal moment occurred with me.
3 minute mark, Chief.
Year one, 1996, 95. I saw some things that that significantly bothered me. I couldn't do anything about it. We couldn't do a single thing about it. Not only what we're talking about, you know, they would fire me. But I should find money in the wrong enough, I have the ability to make a stand somewhere. And so very soon after that, I got promoted. And as I got promoted, I started doing my own thing. Systemically in the agency, we had some issues, got a new chief in, and that's when things really started to change. That's when our focus of this business really started to change. And I've taken those lessons, that mentoring from that chief of police to take me where I am today. This is stuff that's learned. What I do and how I conduct my business comes from a very dear friend of mine who mentored me as a chief of police when he was a chief to get me to where I am today. But very early on, I knew that there were problems.
All right, Big John, you want to take us out?
Yeah, first of all, I thank all of you guys for your services. Said that 15 years ago. I think there needs to be a balance in all of it. Tom's talking about a caste system. Joe's talking about racism. Is he hitting on some points? Everyone, Sarge, Stan. As a country, we need to find a balance. And I think about how that when I was asking the question Tone about fundamental fairness, that when an officer is on trial, is it fair, fundamentally fair, to bring up everything that's going on in every other city while that cop is on trial for a single incident or things ahead? His history does matter, but it's the same thing when John Ruffin is on trial. Is it fair to bring up everything else that's surrounding him, or are we going to focus on the act that he's on trial for? Mm-hmm. And on both sides, there has to be fundamental fairness, and I think even officers deserve fundamental fairness, and it's not fair to bring up all these other things that's going on in America. Yes, we can have those discussions, but far surrounding someone's trial. I think it's for someone who's been through a trial and know what it's like, I think it's absolutely not proper.
All right, John. Go ahead and close us out, bro. Give the goodbyes. You have the chair.
Thank you, everyone. Peace and blessings. Enjoy your weekend and stay away from Joe Mosley.
Please. Yeah, amen. Amen.
And anything out in L.A. So.